In this week's programme, a new biography of James Joyce by Gordon Bowker. The first biography by Herbert Gorman appeared in 1939, 2 years before Joyce died. Richard Ellman's study was published 20 years later in 1959. There have been subsequent books with a narrower biographical focus by Peter Costello and John McCourt. Most books about Joyce are critical studies of the work, a preoccupation much lampooned by, among others, the poet Patrick Kavanagh. One might well ask, though, which kind of material is the more likely to lead us to the work itself, biography or criticism? With me, three Joyce experts, Anne Fogarty of UCD, and the writers and critics Terence Killeen and Gerry O'Flaherty. Anne, what did you make of this? Is there anything of much new in it?
There isn't, even though this is the first substantive and lengthy biography since Ellman, so it, obviously Joyceans are reading it with great eagerness and with forensic intent, attention to the detail that Bowker puts forward. It's still too beholden to Ellman, and Ellman is very problematic as a role model. It gives you a better sense of the texture, the lived experience of Joyce's life, the day-to-day reality of writing, particularly the writing of Finnegan's Wake. You see the toll that it took on Joyce's life, I think. That's more palpable and visible for the first time. Equally, Joyce's struggles with illness of all kinds of imaginable detail and types. Obviously, the iritis is known about, the conjunctivitis and so on, all the problems he had with his eyes. But the nervous collapses, I think I was never quite aware how much they punctuated his life in all of the final years. And this was tied to family troubles, the problems surrounding Lucia, money worries, and particularly the writing
so
of the Wake.
Forgive me, those collapses were more or less confined to the final years, were they?
They seem to have grown apace. They increased in the final years.
Terence, what did you think of this?
Yes, it doesn't produce an awful lot new. On the other hand, it is readable and, you know, helpful for people who might find Ellman a bit of a mountain to chew. Ellman is sort of very scholarly. This is a less scholarly work. He doesn't bring a great deal of new insight or perspective, but he sets out the story quite clearly and quite readably and comprehensively. As Anne says, some of the material in Finnegan's Wake, the later work part particularly, has new elements. And there are things, for instance, that anything English he's good on, he's an English writer himself, and anything to do with London, and that he picks up on very well. He's actually clever that way. You know, he has stuff to say on it. He also, as Anne said again, weaves Finnegan's Wake into the life much better than Ellman did. In Ellman, Finnegan's Wake disappears for long periods while Joyce is writing it, but in this book he keeps in touch with Finnegan's Wake, actually, as Joyce works his way through it over all those years. So those are pluses.
Gerry O'Flaherty, let's hear your account of it.
I disliked it intensely.
Yeah, really.
It was what the pundits for soccer say is a book of two halves. One half, he was a prig, full of himself, obviously knew he was a genius, a sponger, a drinker, and nothing to show for it while he was in Dublin. And then he went away, and according to this book, he lived on Harriet Weaver, and there's a point in it when he says, I think, and it's key to it. On page 479, he says, to Joyce, Harriet was, that's Harriet Weaver, who gave him what would be equivalent to €1.5 million during her life. To Joyce, Harriet was now, and secretly perhaps always had been, a figure of fun from whom to extract money by laying it on as thickly as possible. Now, this to me is absolutely ridiculous. Joyce had made his will. He had made Harriet Weaver his executress, his literary executrix. And he said she was to decide everything about the publishing of his work and deciding where he left her all his manuscripts. So to say that Joyce regarded her as a figure of fun, having accepted a million from her, is, I think, well, he'd be despicable.
Okay, well, let's hear the others on that, Anne.
I think he's partisan where Harriet Shaw Weaver is concerned, but he does tease out the relationship very, very fully. And you get it was a very stormy one. They frequently fell apart entirely, sent each other insulting telegrams and letters and so on. But they also continuously made up with each other. Booker, I think, aims to be as objective as possible. I don't see it as a partisan biography, either pro-Joyce or anti-Joyce, in fact. I think he's aiming to be quite dispassionate. He says, he indicates at the beginning and at the end that he wants to show all of the different facets of Joyce. He does also argue that he wants to get beyond exteriority, and I don't think he does that. I mean, when you read the initial pages of the biography, you presume it'll be a kind of psycho biography.
I get the impression from you, though, Jerry, you feel there's some kind of agenda that he's again Joyce in some way, is he?
Well, I get the impression that the publisher wanted a new biography of Joyce and wanted something new. Not Ellman. This is what he decided. What I don't like about it is that he obviously doesn't know Ireland and doesn't know Joyce. He makes some terrible howlers in it.
Just on the question, though, of attitude and agenda, Terence?
Well, on the Weaver issue, for a start, I mean, there is, in fact, some evidence in Joyce's letters that Joyce was very ambivalent about Weaver. It does seem terribly ungrateful to be dismissive of the person who's given you all that money. But, in fact, in some of the National Library letters that came up in 92, there are quite, you know, I'd say almost contemptuous references to her. So Bowker isn't just inventing this out of nothing. He may have got the balance a bit wrong. I mean, that particular line that Jerry quotes is, I think, putting it too strongly. But at the same time, Joyce is a very difficult person to give money to and expect gratitude from. You weren't going to get that from him, you know? So I would say Bowker, on balance, has that more right than wrong. I have to sort of dissent a little bit there, I think, though I don't like the way he put it very well. But there's some grounds for that. In attitude in general, yes, it's quite true about slighting the Irish side of the Dublin side of Joyce. It's also quite true. He makes some very bad howlers at times, you know. So you couldn't say it was terribly trustworthy for those early years. In fact, I think, you know, Peter Costello's Joyce's The Years of Growth is much better on that sort of line.
How does he handle overall Joyce's attitude to cultural nationalism? He talks about it as being ambivalent, that he supported the independence of Ireland, but not its cultural isolation. His handling of that.
I don't think it's particularly thematised in the biography. It's of slight interest at the beginning when he's talking about Joyce in relation to the literary revival, his relationships with all of the other chief members of the revival, primarily Yeats, Lady Gregory, Synge and so on. Barker seems to be more interested in Joyce relationally, how he connects with people, but he doesn't really contextualise him politically very much at all.
How helpful was Yeats to him, Jerry?
Oh, enormously helpful. I mean, he supported him. I mean, Joyce insulted him in many ways.
He was
so
quite
many,
rude to him.
He was. Yeah. But then when Joyce first was going away, Yeats got up at 6:30 to meet him at the station and brought him around all of the literary magazines and recommended him as someone who could contribute to these magazines. And, of course, Joyce had no gratitude for any of this. He didn't show any gratitude to anyone, really. I mean, to Lady Gregory, who helped him, he didn't, and to Yeats, who helped him. And, as has been said, he didn't show much gratitude to Harriet Weaver.
The attitude to Gogarty was complicated. I mean, he says, Gogarty, Joyce was as jealous and fearful of Gogarty as Gogarty was of him. Does that get it right?
It probably does get it right, I think. And I think he does you know, have that ambivalence to Gogarty also. And he does realise a fellow practitioner in Gogarty, somebody who was also a writer, and in those early days was probably more better known than Joyce as a writer. So there is a definite tension there all the time. Again, Gogarty, in his own way, tried to be helpful to Joyce and got not much out of him in return. In fact, he got hostility. Joyce saw him as an enemy, finally. But at the same time, there was some grudging respect for Gogarty's talents as a poet, I think, in there too.
Joyce was obviously influenced by many things. I mean, by reading of a wide nature. I picked up, though, that Ibsen was of particular importance to him. Has he exaggerated that, Anne? Or
no, not at all. Yeah. No. Certainly Ibsen was hugely influential. In fact, in general in Ireland in the period, there's now much more known about how much Ibsen influenced other Irish writers as well and how important Ibsen was a little bit after Joyce's day on the Irish stage. But Joyce picked up on Ibsen very early and was entirely precocious.
What specifically?
The idea of Ibsen as a writer in exile, as well as the example of Ibsen's work and the themes of Ibsen's writing, an artist that he could see as an outsider in exile who fought for a principle of liberty and was beholden to nothing. So Ibsen became a role model for Joyce in those lights.
So you think he captures that accurately? It hasn't overstressed that, Terence? No,
I think Ibsen was a hugely important figure in Joyce's development, and he was an exemplar of the artistic vocation carried to its full, taking wherever he wanted to go, being disliked in his own country, an exile indeed. And Bowker does evoke some of that, all right. He does get, I think, the sense of Ibsen's importance right, essentially, yeah.
The importance of Nora, how good is he on Nora generally, Jerry?
Oh, he is. He's very good on Nora. Mm. Nora was the most essential thing in Joyce's life, bar nothing. I'd say she was the only one that came before his work. And he couldn't bear to be separated from her at all, ever. When she went into hospital, he went into hospital and was with her there. He worried about her. And, of course, there were fellow soulmates in many ways. I mean, she was as good at spending money as he was.
Yeah.
And
what evidence do we have of how reliant he was on her to evaluate his work? I mean, to keep affirming what he was doing.
Well, the popular idea is that she never read it, which is totally wrong, obviously.
Yes. No. Yes. And she did, you believe?
Oh, yeah. I do believe, yes. Yeah. She could comment on Molly Bloom and what she was like. And obviously they spoke about it. And, of course, Americans don't always appreciate banter. They accept what's said. And if Nora dismissed Joyce in a conversation, who'd read that book, for instance, something like that. Americans tend to take that seriously. Whereas in Ireland we know... Wives always said, who mind that fellow about our husbands? Yeah, yeah. And that's all it is. Yeah. But afterwards, she said that he was the greatest writer that ever was. So, she did appreciate him, and she was essential to him.
I was struck by how helpful Ezra Pound was.
Yes. Yes, and again, that's entirely true, and I think Bowker could have drawn this out much more.
Both in terms of the portrait and Julius's,
You know, Pound was absolutely crucial in getting Joyce's work published and creating an audience for it, and also his early accolades were vital for Joyce. One thing that comes out very clearly in this biography, and very strongly, is how much Joyce reacted to his critics, and particularly the critics he valued, like Pound. So they meant a lot, and all of this got fed into the work. In fact, it seems to have generated a kind of energy for Joyce. The kind of critical reaction was always crucial. It becomes part of the whole creative apparatus.
It didn't matter how bad it energised him. I mean, it didn't matter how upsetting the criticism was.
Occasionally, there's some slights I think he found too hard to take, but even the insulting ones he seems to have relished.
What about the naysayers when Ulysses came out? I mean, he mentions Gertrude Stein, Virginia Woolf, D.H. Lawrence, and our own Sean O'Fallon.
As critics. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. The reaction was, hostile in some quarters, definitely. Virginia Woolf thought he was underbred and sort of a rather jumped-up type who shouldn't really be allowed to write at all, essentially. Joyce, I think, more or less shrugged this off. He wasn't part of the British establishment, literary establishment anyway, so that didn't worry him too much. Gertrude Stein was a sort of a rival firm, if you like, down the street, was doing something different but didn't like what Joyce was up to either. These things didn't bother him much, and he did profit sometimes from negative criticism, actually.
And Sean O'Fallon, would that have upset him?
That did upset him a bit. That actually was, I think, about Work in Progress, which became Finnegan's Wake. I think O'Fallon actually did like Ulysses a lot, but he didn't like
Did he? I got that wrong then. O'Fallon liked Ulysses but had reservations about it. Because what I picked up was that Joyce's primary concern was Richard Aldington's take on the wake. That upset him for some reason.
Yes, it did. Yes, yeah. It did. Well, many people were hostile to the wake. That was by no means unusual. Even Harriet Weaver didn't take to Finnegan's wake too well at all.
Who liked it then? Probably easier to say who liked Finnegan's wake.
Eugene Jolas was one of the big. Yes. He got this
trouble.
Circle.
Yeah. I mean, how do you mean that was the trouble?
I think Harold Nicholson got it right. He when he went to Paris, he was surrounded by a lot of people who wouldn't let anyone speak to him and regard him more or less bowed down in front of him. And Eugene Jolas was one of these. And Joyce was quite happy to stay within that milieu. He didn't mix, for instance, with many people.
There's a talk here of an English Puritan reaction, which can make us feel good. You know, we weren't always the great banners, always the ones in the dark. So that there was an English Puritan reaction, Terence says.
Puritan, yeah, certainly there was a strong British reaction to the obscenity.
Yes, yes.
That's quite true. Yeah. There actually was. I mean, the British Foreign Home Office was very keen to hunt down copies of Ulysses and burn them and that. And even the harmless F.R. Leavis was investigated for wanting to bring a copy over to his students. So, yeah. Yeah.
And even British writers whom you think would respond to Joyce, like D.H. Lawrence, voiced negative criticism, which is quite extraordinary.
Do we have any sense from Joyce of him ranking his own work? I mean, you know, from the poetry to The Wake. Any sense from him, you know, of him ranking that which he thought best and that which was dearest to him and so on?
Of his own
work? His own work, yeah.
I think it is always the fiction. Everything is, on one level, everything is equally important. He had such a struggle. I mean, it's so evident in this biography once again, such a struggle to get any of it published and really out there. He had to obviously struggle a huge long period to have Dubliners published. And it remains a struggle all the way through.
Let me put it another way. Was the poetry more important to him, Jerry, than other people thought it or assessed it? Is that?
It's hard to say. He obviously thought well of it. No one else does. But I think he thought everything he wrote was of importance.
So, yeah.
And poetry was close to music, close to song. So I think that connection remains continuous for him. So he remains obviously very loyal.
There is a kind of revisionist line you hear now. I mean, I'm thinking of writers like John Banville, for example, saying that perhaps Dubliners is more important than Ulysses, ultimately, and so on. Yeah.
That sort of idea is touted about. It is true that in relation to the poetry, Joyce felt it showed another side of him from his fiction, and he valued it that way. His little volume poems, Penny Each, came out soon after Ulysses, and he was very happy that a very different side, a very emotional, personal side of Joyce came out in those poems. In fact, it's an extremely different production altogether. And he liked the idea of people realising there's another side to this man than the massive author of the massive Ulysses. So, yeah.
Onura, how do you rate Dubliners, Jerry, in the terms of the grand oeuvre?
I can't rate it highly enough. I mean, when you think of it, when it was written by a man who was under 25, and when you see what is in it and the depth of meaning that's in it all and the underlying structure that's in it, it's amazing, really, and to think that he wrote The Dead as well, which is probably one of the greatest short stories ever written at such a young age. I mean, this is something that we don't appreciate. A Porter was written when he was in his 30s, and Ulysses was published when he was 40.
Yes.
He died when he was 59.
Terence, you've written about the journalism. He was commissioned by Il Piccolo della Sera to write some stuff. What does the journalism tell us? I mean, presumably, I've always felt that in Dubliners and Ulysses, you get, you know, the God's eye view of the world. And in journalism, he can be partial and tell us what he thinks. So what does the journalism tell us?
It tells us very interesting things about him, which are actually debated a great deal as to what this is all about. It tells us, for instance, that he was more nationalistic than you might imagine, I think, from Ulysses, from the books. In fact, there's a definite... this is written in Trieste, for the Piccolo della Sera, you say, there's a definite sort of tendency to value nationalism.
So the genius of the man was that you don't get that from the fiction. I mean,
well, the genius, the fiction, in a way, transcends all of that. But in the journalism, you have a definite sort of tendency to favour Ireland and its plight.
What's your sense of that, Anne?
Yes, that's certainly true. I think he worked out various ideas and themes within his journalism, so it allowed him maybe to transact things, and also relationships with Irish writers, the essay on Oscar Wilde and the essay on James Clarence Mangan, and there he identified for himself his own literary role models, as it were, within the Irish scene. And there's an argument, of course, that all of his writing is very akin to journalism anyway. He likes the excitement, the fragmentariness of a modern newspaper, and that Ulysses and Finnegan's
yes,
Wake are struck down
but surely
to do this.
Surely essentially different from it in that he avoids the point of view. I mean, that's the power of the of
yes,
the fiction.
Yes, although
it,
he
yeah.
does both. You have omniscient narrators, you have interior monologue, and so on.
Mean,
can do both.
In
yes.
terms of your saying it.
Yes.
He jettisoned his religion, but he needed the guilt. Was it Paul Leong said that he
yes.
he it's, yes. that's quite an insight, and it's
I think this is exaggerated. He did lose his faith, but he was asked why he didn't become a Protestant. He said he lost his faith, not his self-respect. But I think his anti-Catholicism has been exaggerated. I think he became indifferent to religion, rather than Stanislaus's brother, who became virulently anti-Catholic. Joyce more or less sat back and said, it's gone, and he could use it and its symbolism in his own work, and he used it a lot. But I don't think he was totally anti-Catholic.
How do you read that, Terence?
I read it much that light, that he did use it from then on. In A Portrait of the Artist, you have all this terrible guilt and struggle and or torment over sexual misdemeanours and the huge repentance and everything. By the time Joyce wrote that, he had moved past all of that, and he was looking back on it now as a person who had gone beyond it. But it was tremendously useful to him in his fiction. So the idea of a man, you know, ravaged by inner struggle over faith and belief, I don't think it's correct for Joyce after a certain period. Mm. He had more or less put that to one side. So it wasn't an issue.
He wasn't forgiven, though, was he? I mean, in the sense that when it came to the repatriation of the body.
No, certainly. And that weighed heavily against him in the aftermath of his death and so on. And it is quite clear. And I think it is Catholicism that meant he could never return to Ireland. It was quite clear that Ireland was not a country that would receive him kindly. It was the great rebellion of his youth. I think it was his stance against religion and the hold that the church had on Ireland that became part of his rebellion overall against what the church had done, particularly to his family, the toll it had taken on his mother, for instance.
There was no way that the body would have been brought back or allowed back.
Well, that's where Ireland was a great loser. After all, we brought Yeats back, and Mrs. Joyce didn't see why James shouldn't be brought back too. But there was no way that the government wouldn't countenance this at all. And, of course, she got her own back on us very, very well, insofar as Harriet Weaver had the disposal of the Finnegan's Wake manuscript, and she had intended giving it to the National Library. And Mrs. Joyce indicated to her that she didn't think that the National Library should get it, and the National Library didn't get it, although Eliot was in favour of the National Library getting it. But
He's not getting the Nobel Prize. How do you read that, Anne?
Well, there's so many people who didn't get the Nobel Prize. I suppose it does seem surprising, and he's often erroneously listed as one of the awardees. He didn't really win any kind of remarkable prizes during his lifetime. He gains a kind of celebrity that is outside of those kind of spheres for some reason. I think he's too problematic a writer, and Yeats, you can see why Yeats would have gained the
That's an interesting insight on the Nobel crowd. That he was too did you say too complicated?
Yes, and too problematic.
Too problematic, sorry. Problematic is the word, yes. Terence is.
I feel he didn't live long enough to get it. If he had actually lived a bit longer, they might have got around to it. They tend to honour older writers, in fact, who have achieved it.
He was only, 59?
Yes, only 59. Given another 10 years or so, I think it would have come his way, but it was a bit radical for them, as Anna's saying, it's a bit radical for them.
Well,
Jerry.
We should remember that... Garrett Fitzgerald's father did say that he would get the government to put Joyce forward for a Nobel Prize, nominate him for a Nobel Prize. And Joyce's comment was that the only thing that would happen would be that Fitzgerald would lose his portfolio in the government. And, of course, speaking of the Nobel Prize, Proust didn't get one either.
Yes.
So, I mean...
the remark about keeping the professors, people like yourselves, busy... said in what way, in what spirit, Anne?
Yes, it's certainly true, and it's even evident from this biography. In the biographical terrain alone, there's a lot more work needs to be done. A lot of the factual record needs to be set straight. There's a transmission of errors, mistakes from Elman's biography to Boker's.
From Elman's
biography.
Are they? You're nodding there, Terence.
Oh, yes, quite so. He doesn't, in fact, correct Elman much at all. He takes uncritically what Elman has found. I think he does, really, and just
recycles. Has anybody tackled Elman? I mean,
no, there's a real issue there. They haven't. Nobody has. And there is a need
for a
biography.
Flaw,
this has been discussed a good deal, too.
I'm surprised to hear that Elman hasn't been revised. The errors in Elman have not been revised.
Elman's Joyce hasn't been corrected, but Elman's Wilde, a German professor, took it and produced, I think it's an 80-page book, correcting the errors in that.
Yeah.
So, I think that should be done for Elman's biography, a revised...
There is, though, a kind of critical sniffiness about biography in general, isn't there, and its value to literary interpretation?
There's certainly a critical debate. I mean, we have to ask why we read biographies and what kind of function they serve, and equally what kind of service the biographer has to fulfil in writing a life.
It has a value, it has a role.
Yes, certainly, yeah. I think a biography produces a narrative and a version of a writer's life, and particularly for a writer as prominent as James Joyce, we need as many comprehensible and comprehensive narratives as possible, and Booker is certainly to be saluted for at least producing the first full lengthy account of Joyce since Richard Elman in the late 1950s. So we have a new version now.
So meantime, both it needs to be revised and the Elman. You're saying, Terence, yes.
I am saying that, yes. Unfortunately, Booker, as I say, has recycled quite a few of some of Elman's, mistakes and errors, really, to tell you the truth.
The main one being what?
Well, he takes uncritically some of the evidence Elman gathered from people like a man called William Darcy back in the 1950s, who was a highly unreliable narrator of Dublin facts, as Hugh Keller called them.
And he takes Dublin facts. He's absorbed all that.
He absorbed all of that without taking much note of the dubious nature of some of this material.
We've been discussing James Joyce, a biography by Gordon Barker, published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. My thanks to Terence Killeen, Anne Fogarty and Gerry O'Flaherty. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie. Till next week, bye-bye.